Melissa said, because I think what is important is that the accounts reflect the economic reality. And it will often be very difficult, and it will often be subject to management interpretation. That's true, and that's why we should have the robust principles to make sure that there is, the management can take the right decision given the set of circumstances. But I really believe that it's far more important than making everyone do something in the same manner, whether it fits the economic reality or not. And then on similar subject, there is often a mention of comparability as one of the arguments why fair value is better than historical cost. In my view, it's very important to remember that comparability is ability to compare. It doesn't mean that the two assets of two exactly similar assets necessarily need to be reflected in somebody's accounts at exactly the same value, because to me, if I manage to buy this table from a friend of mine for £200 less than a neighbor of mine, I think this is the economic reality and it should be reflected in my accounts. So I think it's equally important, rather than everybody recording it at the value which might be perceived market value.
About 10 years' time, the value of the table, though. I've got an identical table to yours in 10 years' time. Yours is at 200 and mine's at 600. Does that reflect reality?
I do not see the problem with it. And again, that comes to the point, what are you trying to reflect? If I'm a writer and I use this table to put my computer and use it to type on it, I don't see that the value in my books influencing my future cash flows. Therefore, what difference does it make to you? I think
Can I take, that's the point that Peter was making, basically, that if it's in operations and it's the cash flows you're interested in. Now, let's take the same example with a financial instrument. Peter had a different view in that situation. If the table was part of your operating assets, Peter would say it's the cash flows he's interested in, so you can keep them at 200. If, however, we're talking about some investment, you said financial investment, now what would you do, Svetlana?
Well, subject to me being able to reliably enough estimate and have, subject to this table being freely tradable there, where I can take the fair value which is reliable enough, I would agree that it should be at the fair value, because that is projection of my future cash flows.
This is one of the interesting points that we're having here, because Peter's argument, and you agreed with that on investments, but Paul, for example, would be concerned about say, valuing long-term loans or something, if you're holding them for the long term. Now, what do you think should happen then, Peter? There is this thing about the fact that Paul's banks, I think Sylvie mentioned the same thing, want to hold certain things for long term, and I think if trading, you're saying they should be at value, or would you be quite happy to leave them at cost? The original price.
Yeah, well, that is a very difficult question. And I think the fence-sitting answer is to say that you really want both numbers, because with something like a loan, I mean, it is, everybody knows that you could pretty much sort of sell off your whole bank book to somebody else in the capital market in most circumstances. It's actually fairly rare that you find a bank or some financial institution that can't offload its assets or liabilities to another party or variety of parties at some sort of price. So I think you do need to have an assessment of that. In the similar way, really, that with something like a supermarket's real estate, you need to have a view of the fair value of that, the open market value, on the basis that they could sort of raise finance against that value. But you also need to have an idea of what they're actually doing with it. So if it is a long-term book, whether it's an asset or a liability, you also need to have an understanding of the actual sort of cash flows that are coming through. So with a bank, for example, where they're borrowing off their current account holders at 1% and lending out on unauthorized overdrafts at 20%, that 19% spread of cash flowing through the business is something that has more meaning potentially on a sort of daily basis than the mark-to-market value of those two sides of the balance sheet. So I think simple answer is you'd actually need both with that sort of scenario.
A quick comment on the complexity issue. That's true that we are now with a mixed model, but I don't think that the complexity comes from the fact that we have different type of measurement methods, but that it comes from the fact that you want, when you want to apply a measurement method to an item which is not designed to that measurement methods. If you take the example of something and you want to apply fair values to something which is not, which you don't have any market and you don't have a comparable market, then you are going to go into a great complexity in order to build in by using a specific model, which will be entity-specific, in order to determine what would be the fair value of that instrument. So that's very complex. That's very difficult to audit, and that may be very dangerous. Because if you take a bank, for example, and that's something very important for us, if you apply some type of measurement method for things which are really entity-specific and very complex model, then it's very easy for a specific quant team to go out with whatever number they want. And that's very dangerous. That's very dangerous for the management of the company, that's dangerous for the auditors, and that's dangerous for banking supervisors as well. So I get the complexity comes when you use a measurement method which is not adapted to the item.
I'm not sure I agree fully with this. It seems to me that I would agree with you, and we're talking about equities not traded, perhaps, and maybe something along those lines, an option on such. But debt instruments, they're negotiated, willing buyer, willing seller. And both parties had to have something in mind when you arrived at the price you were going to pay. There are derivatives that are long dated, when I think of the energy stuff and some of the scandals around that. And certainly that's difficult to measure when there isn't a curve that you can look at beyond 5 years. But yet two parties got together and agreed on a price at a time. And so I would think a model is relevant and important in that circumstance. But when you say complexity, you can think of it two ways. One is complexity because I'm trying to do the valuation. And the other is complexity because in order to prevent the arbitrage, standard setters put so many rules in the standards that the standard's hard to follow. And I'll give you an example from us. FASB's got some 800 pages in their 133. That was kind of the model that was used for our standard, which is some 400 pages. We started thinking in the SME project, can we get rid of complexity? And I think we're down to 100, 120 pages. But what it says is, and we made a distinction based on instrument where you're not going to selectively get to pick. We said fair value is the default. We're going to make exceptions. So there's an exception for loans and receivables, the normal type of thing you'd enter into. But we didn't define them as loans and receivables. We defined them in terms of their cash flow characteristics and to the extent to which the cash flows are certain, uncertain, with the exception of credit. We left that alone. But I think we can get rid of a lot of complexity if we try to account for the same thing the same way and get rid of the arbitrage. The complexity of the valuation, I think, is there anyway. And nobody seemed to complain about that when we disclose the alternative when we don't recognize it. So I think you can have the best of both worlds, and I think we could make some exceptions. But that's one of the questions that we're really trying to understand in terms of measurement basis. How important is getting rid of complexity?
I just have one observation from earlier, which now is a little bit out of sync, so apologies for that. But I was just thinking about the concept of the cash generating unit, you know, that you were speaking of earlier, and in particular in relation to a services company, be it a financial services company or an accounting firm, et cetera, and the fact that the vast majority of that value is actually not created by the property and equipment, by the people that come to work every day. And as a result, if in trying to discount cash flows and calculate that, by backdoor, effectively what we're doing is internally generated goodwill, putting employee contracts and other things on the balance sheet that we currently don't reflect on the balance sheet. And I was just wondering on the views overall about whether that makes sense. I guess if we were going to go closer towards value and use for the organization as a whole, I would think you would have to consider everything that's off balance sheet, as well as those things that are currently recorded, be they at cost or fair value.
Do you want to come in there just ahead of Ian to answer that point?
Sorry, that point's very easy. Yes, it does involve taking internally generated goodwill onto the balance sheet, because when you're managing value, that's what you manage.
Ian in there.
Yeah, sure. Thank you, David. Actually, I was just going to come back at Peter, because I think what I'm hearing around the table is sort of the benefit of multiple perspectives. So I have, I guess, a picture developing of three income statements and three balance sheets. And I wondered if we were sort of searching around for a different sort of reality, because I guess to me, the notion that I get somebody to project cash flow forwards, then discount them back and produce a point estimate, sort of seems to me there's rather better quality information out there than the point estimate. There is the cash flows which management has put together in order to do that forecasting to be able to generate that item. And I'm conscious in the US in how analysts look at insurance companies, the data set that they principally look at is not the US GAAP numbers, but actually they get the regulatory returns, and in the regulatory returns they have the cash flow forecast. So Peter, can I tempt you? If you were given the option for your pensions of what the expected cash flows were, you know, a 20-year analysis with the numbers in it, would actually that be your highest and best data set that you'd be interested in for your month-long exercise of having the drains up? And do you have a preference of what you put in the 30-minute, i.e. that 6:30 in the morning? Because I'd like us to come back to what I think of the primary statements is the 30-minute challenge, not the month. So sort of two questions to you. Your ideal data set? Yes, I think the ideal data set, well, management forecast cash flows would be fantastic. And that's something that analysts are always trying to sort of tease out at meetings with management. And there are all sorts of reasons why we can't get it, including sort of regulatory ones, that companies are generally sort of not encouraged to make profit forecasts. And if they do, then they're sort of held accountable for them. So directors are actually reluctant to reveal to the open market what they think will happen in real cash flow terms. But yes, absolutely, that is one of the key things analysts and investors are trying to get to. They want to understand management view in terms of what will happen in the future, what is going to come in terms of cash flow. How does that relate to the sort of the difference between the 30-minute and the sort of the two-month view, as it were? Well, I guess what people are trying to do on a 30-minute basis, first thing in the morning at sort of, you know, Monday, 7 o'clock, the news just comes out. What they're really trying to do is they're trying to assess what the company has actually achieved against what they thought it would. And that will be in terms of future cash flows. So what were future cash flows have now become realized. And it will be in terms of sort of margins that the market thought the company was going to make sort of X on each unit it sold, or however many times the consultants got out the door, or whatever it might be, and actually they made X minus or X plus. It's those sorts of comparisons that the market is making on that 30-minute view. They're really just saying, look, you know, we thought you were doing really well on a sort of, you know, these are the way the flows are going, and actually, whoa, it's not looking so good. Or we thought you were doing rather badly, and actually it's looking a lot better. And it's also trying to differentiate, and again, this is key, how much of the sort of overall underperformance, overall under sort of achieving, how much of that is sustainable, and how much of that is sort of good luck, or you know, much more short term. Those are the sorts of things people are trying to understand. Yeah, can I just come back? I mean, I find this world fascinating, because I thought I knew what analysts would do, because I related it to my own experiences, and then realised I'm quite a long way from reality. And your experience you just recounted there, I did a Meet the Experts conference and had a guy called Guido Kirchhoff on the stand, and we did a discussion about from Deutsche Telekom. And recently they did a legal merger, and that required them to produce for the market a fair value balance sheet of the total of the organization and a 10-year forecast of earnings.
And he said all of the questions and the fascination was about the forecast as opposed to the point estimate. And so I guess to me the question that I would like us to think more about and would encourage the board to think more about is, so what does that mean for what's the most useful data set in its totality? And that might have a lot more cash flow forecast in it. And how do we serve the 30-minute need? We may wish it didn't exist, but actually that's a clear need of the market that we need to address.
Your next point.
This is a relatively quick one, David. I was going to come back on the cash flow point that Ian has come back on to a larger point, that analysts want the cash flows, management are the best people who know the most about cash flows. There must be a way of trying to transfer that information, whether it's actually to give them the cash flows and publish them, let everybody see them, or to publish the assumptions upon which those cash flows are based. And then I think the way that management accountability would then operate is that if the market takes management's cash flow data and their weighted average cost of capital data and comes to a totally different valuation from that management does, the implication is management is judged badly, either as being unambitious and they've put the price higher, or being over-optimistic and useless and put the price lower. And I think you would see a completely different way of using accounts of this sort and to get the intervention decision coming in. And you could see new governance or stock exchange rules emerging along the lines of, if the value, the market cap of your business is more than 20% different from the fair value, from the value and use that you've put on it, you've got to make a statement or sack the chief executive or have another audit or something. I think the world would change in the way these things are done.
Thanks, Doug. A couple of things. Just about the 30-minute analysis, I'm not exactly sure that's the role of accountants to worry about it. If you're trying to reduce 100-plus pages of annual report for an incredibly complex series of transactions, which is already aggregated, then into 30-second or 30 minutes, that's your lookout or the analyst's lookout. That's got nothing to do with what this sort of thing's about. It just sounds pretty brutal, doesn't it? But I thought, you've got to meet that deadline. That's your business. It's outside the whole scope of accounting. I would have thought to put it all on one number, I think, is asking to go for a belting. Dot-coms would be a classic example. Everyone just watch the number. What's the number doing? I'll keep riding the market. Where's the real analysis? Just on something else, though, coming back to something Sylvie said about, or sort of alluded to, the ease of manipulating fair value numbers sort of comes back to something I said a while ago, a risk of low quality accounting standards. Back home, there's a particular company, fairly famous, that's picked up transport infrastructure real estate, significant asset, and they've structured themselves in a particular way where the change in the fair value of this land has gone through the income statement, and then the change in the fair value of the unlisted shares in the entity that owns the particular asset has also gone through its parents' income statement. The point you're making is one of them is a financial instrument, unlisted, the other one is land, publicly known, but from all indicators there's no reason at all to believe it's increased something like 60% in value over 3 years. So I agree with you, Sylvie, that it's not a clear-cut, easy thing to say, oh, this number's a solid number. And I think you said it, Ian, fair value is a range of numbers at best, and I agree with you big time. How we deal with that, I don't know.
I was actually going to make a similar point, and it's not about, not in only in situations where you effectively do your mark-to-market and have your model and estimate it, but even in a normal transaction between two parties which are independent, I think fair value is just a notion which I don't think as a number it exists, because it's just a matter of negotiations and how it's so many factors in it and such a big range that a notion of having one number which will be remotely objective, I think, is just non-existent. And it's very telling, the example I was talking to our M&A guys, and they're talking about a transaction and how account for it. So I told them, well, okay, for accounting, I'll need your fair values. And the answer from there said, well, what do you mean fair value? What is fair value to you? So it just doesn't exist in anybody's minds. So of course, they have a range to which they negotiate, but it is a fairly wide range. So and whoever is better negotiating, whoever is in a better position, that's where you end up. I really don't think it's just an objective measure whatsoever. And lastly, I'll just have to say, I think we have to articulate what is wrong with historical cost as well. And I believe that where it's relevant, historical cost might not be perfect, and there might be certain areas where it needs to be fine-tuned. But I think also in our discussions, those small, I believe, imperfections of historical cost should not warrant it irrelevant. So I think it is important, because, and maybe it's misconception of a lot of preparers, but when I talk to people in my organization, a lot of people believe that ISB thinks historical cost is not very good, not good enough, therefore will go to fair value. I know it's oversimplified perception, but I think it's the reality.
No, it's the reality of the perception, I think. But it doesn't mean to say it actually is going to happen. I mean, one of the reasons we're having this, Svetlana, is to say which items do you think should be at fair value and which ones do you think should be at cost? I mean, bluntly, that's what we're talking about. And Peter's given his views, we've got a different one from Neil, and what we're trying to do is to say, well, where should we go? And we haven't got a firm view. We wouldn't be bothering having this if we had. And that's what we're trying to work out. Where exactly do we do it? You haven't heard very many people here today say everything should go to fair value, but you haven't heard very many saying everything should be at cost either. And okay, where's the cut? That's what we're after. And can we get it? Robert, you're going to give us it, hopefully.
I suddenly find I don't want to speak. But I think actually in that question of where the cut comes, I suspect that in Peter's opening comments, which I agreed with, there was some reflection really of an excellent paper Stephen Penman gave at our conference, which kind of made this distinction between what's in your business model for buying things cheap, putting them together, adding your own magic sprinkle of your business, sprinkling your magic business model over it, and you get bigger cash flows out the other end. And that's the kind of operating model where actually historical cost kind of works, because you want people to prove that they can achieve this magic by actually realizing cash flows. You don't particularly want, I know it's cruel to say it, but just the mere idea of Enron and Blockbuster having a great idea of how they might form a business, create a business model and fair valuing it. Well, actually, it's quite important to wait till you deliver it in real transactions. So that idea of splitting off what your sort of business model is between where you're actually buying things and then converting them and selling them and adding value is a different from things which you have available to realise in a market, and actually you're not adding value in quite the same way. And from that kind of simple position, then you start to see concerns about, well, are they really not telling us, giving us information that we need to evaluate whether they should be breaking up that business model and realising assets elsewhere? Can they play games because they pretend things are part of their business model and then they securitise them next week? And those are definite sort of issues, but I think we can't solve everything by trying to deal with rules about how things shall be reported and measured, because in that issue there's just some basic recognition that actually you do need quality people who are going to have integrity in how they report, and whatever standards you have, you can't have people refusing to answer questions and not telling you and then springing surprises. And similarly, you have to recognise that things will nevertheless change, that what and I see no problem with what Peter was saying, that last year people might not have been interested in this and this year they are. Well, that's just the way reporting evolves. Nobody's saying the ISB has got to come up with a set of standards and then, you might think it's a nice idea, sort of go away for 50 years and they'll work fine for the next 50 years. This is an iterative model where businesses react to the standards as they exist and things evolve. So I don't think the kind of but problems with that basic split need to be too debilitating in terms of that being a basic insight, which seems to command quite a degree of consensus both for investors. And what's quite interesting is it doesn't really seem to be radically inappropriate for SMEs. because people might actually quite buy into that idea. It's not one of these things where you say, well, you're having a conversation which is all right for these, big capital market companies, but I don't understand it. I actually think that that's got quite an appeal as a model generally, and I think it is important that whatever we deliberate today, realise that in setting some expectations about how measurement happens for the ISB's main target market, will have an influence on everyone else, because it will be seen as the best way of doing things, and anything else is exemptions or second rate or cheap alternatives. If we can find something which, recognising that you're not primarily aimed at everyone, but if we can find something that resonates as a sort of intuitive way of going about making measurement decisions, which works generally, I think that would be very helpful. Just a couple of other comments to make, if I may. First of all, I am always enjoy hearing Neil's explanation of the only true path, and I think that where I come on this is that it's very interesting accounting, but it's accounting, Jim, but not as we know it. In that, it seems to me that it's another very important, potentially important part of the information set people might want, and I've no problem with saying that to have cash flows would be great, but it actually risks whatever say about, well, having the historical cost, recoverable historical cost numbers at the top. It nevertheless would distract from conventional accounting in that we would be presenting a very summary form of discounted cash flow information, where actually people will want to be able to dig behind it. So for that one number in the balance sheet, you might need 80 pages of stuff to be able to get your hands around it. And we do have there's a few people even in this room who worked on a project that the ICAW was involved in some time ago about prospective financial information and the limits on what can be done in a regulatory context with that. And it's a different area, and it might well be that in the conceptual framework approach, it's worth thinking about the publication of prospective financial information, but I'm not quite sure that it's to supplant accounts as we know it. I think it's interesting, but I don't primarily think it's an issue about kind of measuring the boring things, which are the assets and liabilities we've got, and not forgetting the income statement, whatever it is we want to measure in the income statement. And I suppose one final comment, and it's just to make sure that we don't get too focused on, if you like, trying to come up with the answer in terms of how we want to account for anything, everything. I think an important part of this process is to think about the way in which the board should make decisions in a structured way about measurement issues, because they're going to keep cropping up as business evolves and different problems emerge. And I think rather than try and sketch, what things should look like, it's important to get an idea of a basic language, not only of how we describe different measurement bases, but also how we describe the kind of process that you go through for implementing changes. And that's really, what those in regulatory positions are increasingly being expected to do. What are the kind of rules of the game? And following up from Peter's comment, where do we start off with the am I bothered sort of question? It is part of actually just a process of good regulatory practice. And I think having a language for how we think about these issues, so that we properly understand whether a change is needed. And it's not just that a change would be nice if somebody else is paying for it, but is a change actually going to deliver a model that's fit for purpose? Is a kind of broader aim of what we should be about. Thank you.
Yeah, I've got Ian, then Paul.
Thank you. Just a couple of points, David, if I may, come out of what other people have said. The first one is that as one of those who argued at the outset that different users need different sorts of numbers, that you have different needs for that made want different valuations for the same thing. I would strongly stress that, in my view at least, that no way should lead to three balance sheets and three sets of accounts, as somebody said. I don't think that's the answer at all. If you go back to Svetlana's £200 table and whether it should really be valued at 600 or 200, the answer in my book is it doesn't actually matter which you value it at. What does matter is that the user of Svetlana's accounts understands the basis on which it has been valued, and if that user would have preferred it to be valued on some other basis, they've got at least enough information, absolute minimum, to recognise that it is on the basis that they didn't want, and ideally they've got enough information to make some sort of rough estimate of what it would be if it was valued on the basis that they want. But that's not the same as having three different sets of accounts, heaven forbid. The other point, it was just to touch on Peter's comment about management cash flows. Having worked for, just short of 30 years for two very large multinationals, each of which was a very high repute, or supposedly, I would caution against the value of management cash flows. My experience is that management are really quite astonishingly bad at producing cash flows that have any real accuracy. And there are all sorts of reasons for that. One is just because the world is a difficult place and the world changes and so on. But there are also all sorts of other overlays on it, such as what other managers in the group expect from them, how the chief executive is setting his objectives, what managers think analysts want, what they think shareholders want, et cetera, et cetera. And now, managers are quite good, in my experience, at forecasting what the earnings for the current year are going to be, not least because there's usually a bit of scope in deciding what the earnings actually are when you've got that, but that's a separate point. But anything longer term than that is dangerous, and it really is very dangerous, I think, to start in. I mean, prospective financial information generally should be taken with very, very large spoonfuls of salt if it's out there. And it's not because managers in general set out to mislead. It's because managers are subject to all sorts of pressures internally, and because in many cases, and it goes back again to the discussion we've been having in this room about subjective probabilities applied to large contingent liabilities a few weeks back, managers are very bad often at assessing how probabilities fit, and frequently, in my view, having a period of some years out of those 30 earned my living talking to analysts about how a very large multinational was trying to perform, often the analysts were actually better at making the forecast than we were internally because they had a better view of looking at it objectively.
Well, I'm always very encouraged when somebody says that we have a better ability to come up with cash flows than they do, because that's what gets us paid. So that's fantastic. So thank you very much indeed. And actually, I mean, you know, in seriousness, I know, having sort of worked for a real business before I got my current job, that, you know, absolutely, managers in individual divisions produce the cash flow that their boss wants. I remember one of my sort of bosses saying, "Remember, your budget is written in your own blood." Which was quite a dramatic way of making me manufacture a budget that would please him and then planning an exit route as well, which you can see that I took. So yes, I mean, I entirely take your point on the sort of the veracity or the ability of managers to forecast the future. And yes, in some circumstances, investors do have a better view because they look at a variety of companies and they can see the whole market rather than a sort of single silo view. That does actually bring me on to another point, which is, again, this reliability of cash flows and sort of, you know, fair values. And I do think this is an issue for investors, that if we are publishing fair values, which are produced as a result of any sort of assumptions, as most of them will be, there are very few sort of values out there where you really can say, there's a market price, this is the same asset, you know, like a bond, same duration, same coupon, same credit risk, so that's got to be that price just as the other one was that price. Most things actually involve a degree of assumption. And investors are skeptical of those values, and I think rightly so. Forecasting the future, as investors know, is very, very difficult. And they don't believe management mark to model is particularly meaningful in some circumstances. So, you know, the further you get away from a market where there is ready trading, the less reliable those numbers get. And it may be that the most reliable number is sort of what you paid for the thing in the first place. Now, that doesn't mean that that's the single number you want, the only number you want. That doesn't mean that's the answer. That doesn't mean that's the sort of the best way of looking at it. But it does mean that that number is important, because that was a real transaction that you can sort of date and you know who took part in it and you know that that number actually occurred. That is a historic event. And I think it's very important to bear in mind that that sort of historicity, that historical truth may not be quite the answer you want because it's not today's number, but it's a real event. And therefore, in that sense, it has meaning and it has reliability. And we'd be silly if we just threw that particular baby out with sort of the bathwater in trying to get to something else. So, and I wouldn't want you to think that I'm saying historical cost is the answer, because I hope you've understood from what I've said earlier this afternoon that it's absolutely not. But that is a reliable starting point. And as an analyst, I might prefer to say, well, 5 years ago, I know you bought the building for X, and I can see how the market in buildings has developed, so I can make an estimate as to where it is now, which I might trust more than management's estimate.
I think I agree with what Peter's just said, and that sounded quite different from what I thought I heard earlier, because I think that what I just heard was an account of the fact that the further you get away from a liquid market, the more you become concerned about the reliability of fair value numbers. And on that basis, you might believe that original value tells you more about real events. And I think that's the reason why we would consider that when it comes to the loan book, rather than placing merit on the fact that there are instances where loans are traded, we'd like to look at what is the predominant experience. And as Sylvie's mentioned, in Europe, it's very clearly that contracts are entered into and those contracts are held to maturity. And therefore, I think that if we're looking at putting users into a position of looking at what management have said that they want to do and then actually judging them against whether or not they delivered against that, then actually information about the original contract terms, the quality of their credit decisions, the impairment experience, it strikes me that this is a more relevant basis on which to place value on loans held to maturity than fair values. And I don't think any of us are saying that fair value is not of relevance and not of interest, but I do think that the more relevant basis for the accounts has to be historical cost.
Well, I think I wanted to comment on the cash flows and what needs to be put on the balance sheet. I think one of the comments is that disclosure is not a replacement for recognition, and I think in general I completely agree with it. Then the question becomes, okay, whatever number we put in the balance sheet, is it the most useful way or is it the most representation of assessing future cash flows? And that's my example of the table. Coming back to my industry, and maybe I'm a bit too subjective about how great the accounting in oil and gas accounting is, but in some ways I think we're lucky because we have relatively homogeneous product, and it is relatively easy to disclose the inputs whatever you would need to use in the cash flows, but talking to some of our investment and investors, it feels like that the disclosures which the oil and gas companies do have, while far from being perfect, are quite suitable. And yes, we need to work on them, et cetera, but at large, they're very helpful in projected future cash flows. However, the comment, which I think is very important, is that a lot of the companies who are reporting for the U.S. Produce the disclosures, which is called standardized measure of oil and gas, which effectively values the values the cash flows at the year-end price at 10% discount. And we were told by a number of investors that actually this disclosure is it's very useless because all they need is the inputs in it, because all they do is unwind all of the assumptions and use the volumes. They do need the volumes, they do need the costs and whatever inputs they need to get into the model, as opposed to the outcome. And I think that's very telling. If you now tell me that I will need to come to better assumptions. Okay, it's not going to be year-end price. It will be my view on the future price. It will be my view on the discount rate. It's still going to be my view. It's not going to be the view of individual users, which probably differ. And put it even more on the balance sheet, I really just don't see the value of that exercise while disclosing it. It seems very, very helpful. But again, we are very lucky because we have oil and gas and, okay, a few more products. It's much more difficult if you're producing a range of retail products. I don't know the solution for that, but...
It's interesting you mentioned the oil and gas, and obviously, as you know, we have, and you mentioned, we have this project, which is going to be a few years before it happens. What do you think that Peter should get as far as your oil reserves are concerned? I mean, what was your ideal accounting for that then? You've got these oil reserves. Now, what do you tell Peter? Or what should he really know?
I think it is slightly difficult subject because obviously a lot of the information is commercially sensitive because we don't want everybody to know our view on all of the future outcomes from individual reserves. Overall, I think if we didn't have that issue, I think he should have our estimate of the future reserves production by year, and he should have my estimate of the cost to be able to produce his cash flows. But it's not that simple because I do believe it's important to keep in mind that a lot of this information is very commercial sensitive, and while I understand that accounts have to be transparent, et cetera, it comes the time when it becomes too commercially sensitive and it becomes dangerous. So where this balance lies again, in ideal world, I know the answer. In reality, I think it's not as far extreme. I don't know. Peter, would you feel that would suit your needs?
Is that enough, Peter?
Yeah, it sounds good to me. I mean, I think analysts are always going to want to push you hard on the commercial sensitivity point. But yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, we want to know sort of how much is in the ground. What's your best estimate of what's actually, you know, under the North Sea or Saudi Desert or wherever it might be? And how difficult you think it's going to be to get out, how long you think it might take or how quickly you can get it out. And then we can start valuing that on the basis of where we think the oil price might be when you actually get the stuff out of the ground and start shipping it.
So we'll look forward to BP's accounts next year then. Okay, Mark.
Thanks, Doug. Sorry to keep picking on you, Peter, but you raise an interesting point. I think I interpreted it right when I think you said that lots of estimates are taken into or are used in fair value accounting, and you said that investors don't have a lot of faith in these numbers. Is that an accurate representation? Does that raise an issue for the quality of the accounting standard as far as you're concerned as an analyst, or do you just think it's part of the real world, just got to deal with it?
Yeah, I don't think we would blame accounting standards as such for the quality of the estimates. I think there are two issues really with estimates. Some things are just difficult to estimate, and analysts and investors are trying to estimate those difficult things themselves. So they're very well aware that future cash flows, how businesses work, what life will be like in 10 years' time, that's just a very, very hard thing to work out because, you know, the butterfly flaps in Brazil and the cyclone happens in sort of, you know, the Midwest of the US or whatever. And there's just too much that we don't know at the moment to really be able to come up with a view. So I don't think we would hold accounting standards themselves responsible for that issue. What we would want is to have a very clear view of how the number itself had sort of been produced. And a number of people have mentioned this idea. And again, going back to pensions, which is an easy example to talk about, some companies in the UK now very helpfully saying, if we change our discount rate by 50 basis points, the liability moves by X percent or, you know, Y amount. And that's very helpful because it just says, look, you know, here's a spot number, but actually that's just, you know, the midpoint of the range or the best estimate of a sensible point on the range, but there is a range and sort of here's roughly how that range might look. And actually you then know the range could go even further. So that's helpful to have some idea of the sensitivity of the model. So sort of Svetlana's point about, you know, reveal the oil that's in the ground and then you can make your own assumptions, that's one way of doing it. another way is for her to make her assumptions, tell us the value of the stuff that's in the ground, but to tell us the assumptions she used. So she's used a $50 oil price. I think it could be 70. And I have an idea as to how her model would operate to give me a different result so I can play with the sensitivities. That's all fine. We can cope with assumptions if we know the sensitivities. Where it becomes more of an issue is if you've got people who are actually making, if you like, what I would call the wrong assumptions and not being sort of required to then reveal that by accounting standards. That's where you can get sort of Enron scenario, somebody marking to their own model, not telling me how they've done it, and just saying, well, that's the answer, and I have to take that.
I'm just about to close, but Trish, you want to come in?
I had a question for the group because it's something that Mary asked the group that we had first thing this morning. It seems to me that when we talk about fair value and historical cost as if they were two entirely different things, except for that at the point at which you establish cost, as I think John said, generally speaking, historical cost and fair value are the same thing. So they're not choices at the beginning. I think one of what we're struggling with, though, is answering the question about why and when we should change the basis of measurement and what we might change it to. And people have, I think, fairly consistently said, we don't want to mark everything all the time. And we really think that historical cost is perfectly okay and we should just leave it alone. Do those people also think that should be true for downs as well as ups, i.e., do we, in that model, do we ignore impairments because they have exactly the same kinds of estimation issues as all of the fair value things that people are so uncomfortable about? So I guess I'd be interested in finding out does that work both ways. So that's one question. And the other question is, Robert said something which I thought was really important, which is that the whole, and I think he's caught the whole purpose of the project, which is that he said the board should think in a structured way about measurement issues, and that's exactly what we're trying to develop a conceptual framework for, is to give ourselves the structure to think about them in. But then, and I think someone was criticizing Kevin's project plan for saying we're going to think about practicalities when we get to stage three, milestone three. I guess one of the things that I wanted to follow up with a point that Sylvie made, which is, well, some of this stuff at the moment might not be doable or practical or give us too wide a range of precision to require that measurement, but heck, some of you guys are operating in markets that didn't exist 30 years ago. And if we want to develop a conceptual framework that's going to last until next Tuesday, that's one thing. If we want to develop something that is actually going to be able to be usable by standard setters for some reasonable length of time, I guess the question is, do we leave some of the practicality, do we try to come up with what we think is the best answer and then leave it to the standard setters to try to apply the practicalities in the standards level issues? Or should we try to rule stuff out at the conceptual level right off the bat when in another 5 years there might be a breakthrough in thinking in terms of figuring out how to do this in a sensible way and a market develops, and we've said, no, that's off the table before anybody could even think about it. So those are two kind of, we probably don't have time to answer them, but in philosophical, I'd be interested in the reaction of people if you have more thoughts to get back to us on that, because those are things that really worry me about how we're thinking about some of these issues.
Thanks, Trish. Robert, you have 30 seconds to answer those questions.
I thought it was a rather stark contrast between historical cost and fair value, which didn't seem to reflect the fact that...
It wasn't
a contrast, it was identical. No, sorry, a contrast once you've passed the initial acquisition, because... You know, the recoverable amount tests are a form of fair value. So the idea that there's pure historical cost seems a little bit of an Aunt Sally. Sorry, is that a very UK phrase? And The second question about the conceptual framework, does it stay the same for years? Well, I think there's two answers to that. First of all, it should be under review because it's a working method for how you're going to develop regulation, and any regulator would have a model of how they regulate, which is not meant to only last for a few minutes, but that doesn't mean it's shut down forever. So I wouldn't have expected this stage of the project to close things off so that before you could even then think about a standard which envisaged using a particular method, you'd have to reopen the conceptual framework. That seems a little bit more nailed down than I would have expected.
I don't think it'd be quite like that because we are fairly flexible when it comes to that, I think, Robert. I remember our former board member, Jeff Whittington, giving a lecture entitled Inflation Accounting, All the Answers. And people trotted along to get the answers, but they got all of them. There were hundreds of them. And in a way, that's what we know we're facing just now. The idea, as Trish and as you said too, Robert, was we're looking for a toolkit, the way to make decisions on measurement issues, the when, the why. We've had some interesting ideas today. We can see just the diversity out there. You know, some arguing that cost is fine for operating assets, and others saying no, we want replacement costs, which we got in the last session, or Neil's present value, investment assets probably at fair value, financial instruments. Some would argue all fair value. Others would say that's part of the operating. For various companies, and what we have to do is look at that, plus disclosures, plus how we present the information and performance reporting, so it's all connected. So thank you for coming. This is, as you know, a very early stage. This is not going to be fixed in the next few weeks. We'll be going through a discussion paper in due course, and then an exposure draft, and we'll probably be asking for your comments yet again. But thank you very much for taking the trouble to come and giving us your views. I hope you go away from here realizing that we don't think fair value for everything is the answer. It's just, when do we use it, when is it most useful, and when is historical cost better? Thanks very much indeed. Thank you.